Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, a new audit is critical of another state agency, this time the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services. What are the findings? We'll have that for you. While there is concern over abortion rights, as many expect the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade, Illinois is still considered a haven for those seeking the procedure. But that doesn't mean advocates aren't looking at additional action. Despite agriculture producing a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, many in the industry don't believe humans are responsible for a warming planet. A program seeks to find common ground on the topic. We'll tell you about a program designed to reduce recidivism when a prisoner is released, and a serviceman killed at Pearl Harbor has finally come home. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll discuss the abortion debate in Illinois, specifically what might happen if Roe v. Wade is overturned. We'll also recap a new state audit that examines problems with the state's child welfare agency and trying to find common ground in the ag community when it comes to climate change. Those stories and more on the way. Well, it took 80 years, 4 months, and 27 days after a West Central Illinois sailor was killed at Pearl Harbor that his remains finally came home. Jane Carlson and Rich Egger bring us that story.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
23-year-old Navy Fireman First Class George Franklin Price was aboard the USS Oklahoma on that day. He was among nearly 400 sailors on that battleship who were classified as unrecoverable following the attack, and whose unidentified remains were buried for decades at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, known as the Punch Bowl. But the Navy's effort in recent years to identify those sailors using DNA analysis means his family got the chance to honor him and bury him in his hometown. Price grew up in a large family in Dallas City, right on the Mississippi.
Yes, we'll gather at that river, the beautiful river.
We're at the river. What better song?
Amen.
Uncle George grew up on this river. They lived off of this river.
That's Joyce Martin, one of Price's 7 living nieces and nephews. They were all born after their Uncle George died, but they know he was especially close with his 5 sisters.
On this table is roses. There's 5 red roses in that vase. Those 5 red roses represent the sisters. The 2 blue ones represent his mom and dad, and the white one represents Uncle George.
Martin says Uncle George was still a big part of the family, in the stories the sisters told, and in the grief they carried over the years.
I know that the loss was great on the family. I know I often heard the sisters say that Grandma just never got over it, and I'm sure Grandpa didn't either.
Price was awarded a Purple Heart, Combat Action Ribbon, and Navy Good Conduct Medal for his service. Those came home with him to Dallas City. Another emotional homecoming for the nieces and nephews, whose mothers, those 5 sisters, have all passed away.
My mother was Pearl Price. She loved him so much.
That's Price's nephew, Franklin Freeman, also a veteran.
We're talking about somebody that none of us knew.
That's right.
Nobody knew him. But we know through the sisters, one of them being my mother, but it was very special.
Freeman and the others now take comfort that Uncle George's final resting place is in Dallas City, in the same cemetery as the sailor's parents, and between 2 of those sisters.
So now he'll be right beside her.
Rolling Thunder, which promotes the needs of veterans, escorted the white hearse from the funeral home to Harris Cemetery on the south edge of town. They were accompanied by many of the more than 150 people who attended the funeral home service. Hundreds and hundreds of American flags lined the entire 2.5-mile route, Hundreds of people did too, some saluting as the motorcade drove past. Students from Dallas City Elementary School, many dressed in red, white, and blue, also lined the route before joining the family, military veterans, and many others in an even larger crowd at the cemetery where the remains of George Franklin Price were laid to rest.
Right,
Ronald Pettigrew led the graveside service. He is the Navy chaplain for the 7th Fleet, the same Pacific Fleet Price served in. Pettigrew says Price and Oklahoma's crew were dedicated to their ship and their mission.
That is the legacy that we honor here today. And as we stand here and we look at the 700 flags and at the motor detail, this is what America is about.
After taps, as is the military tradition, the six sailors who carried the casket removed the flag draped over it and folded the flag into a triangle. It was then handed to Pettigrew.
On behalf of the President of the United States.
Pettigrew, in turn, presented the Stars and Stripes to Joyce Martin.
As I stand in proxy of my brother Albert, I accept this flag with gratitude and gratefulness. And we thank you for your service and everyone that's gathered here today.
A proverb says, good men must die, but death cannot kill their names. The name George Franklin Price lives on, remembered as a hero by scores of people who never met him, including the nieces and nephews who never got to know their Uncle George.
For towns with only a few hundred residents, keeping tap water clean and safe can pose a daunting expense. And as David Kondos of the Kansas News Service reports, that is likely to become more common in places where chemicals from farms seep into dwindling water supplies.
In most parts of the country, you can turn on just about any faucet and expect water that's clear, clean, and cheap. But as chemicals make their way into rural Kansas drinking water, a growing number of small towns face a different, expensive reality.
These meters over here.
In the town of Haviland, former Mayor Robert Ellis walks through a maze of pipes toward a small meter on the wall.
This is showing what our nitrates are right now, 8.4.
And if that meter goes much higher, you'll know it.
There's a horn that goes off in there, so you think you're at a basketball game. And rock, you know.
Haviland's drinking water went over the federal limit for nitrates a decade ago, so it had to build this $2.5 million water treatment plant, paid for by a town of just 700 people. Today, that water's cleaner, safer, but Ellis says that when Haviland residents see the plant, they just think about how much it's costing them.
They've been drinking out of the garden hose for all their lives. They don't worry about the nitrates. It's a beautiful plant. We ask them if they want to look at it and see it, and they don't. All they look at is their water bill.
Those water bills have just about tripled. Ellis says the town originally tried to save hundreds of thousands of dollars by installing water filters in everyone's homes, but the state told him that wasn't good enough. If Haviland didn't build this plant, Ellis says it would have been fined thousands of dollars a day.
So that's quite a battle, but as usual, the government won.
City Council President Kay Unruh says that for a town this small, a multi-million dollar project is a big burden, and another example of the state or federal government not trusting rural Kansans to decide what's best.
Our hands are tied financially because all of our resources are going to comply with all these regulations. We feel like we're being strangled.
Haviland isn't alone. $6.6 million for Lakin in southwest Kansas, $4.7 million for Oberlin in northwest Kansas. In Woodston, near Hayes, more than $1 million for a town of just 100 people. And more than 30 other small towns are over the legal limit right now for everything from arsenic to uranium to chemical byproducts of the treatment process itself. But the most common problem in Kansas is nitrates. Think farm fertilizer. An Iowa State University study shows that since the 1940s, the use of nitrogen fertilizer nationwide has increased 34-fold.
We can't be surprised that we have increasing levels of nitrate in our water when we know that we're putting down increasing amounts of nitrogen on the land.
David Swertney directs the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination at the University of Iowa. And he says federal regulations that set tap water standards more than 20 years ago need updating. New research says drinking the chemicals for years could cause cancer and birth defects, even at concentrations below the legal limits.
We know so much more about what chemicals are out there and what the chemicals we know about can do to us. Nitrate's a great example.
But what about the people adding fertilizer to the ground? Kent Askren with the Kansas Farm Bureau says that with fertilizer prices at historic highs, farmers have a financial incentive to apply it efficiently.
Sometimes the picture is painted that agriculture is, you know, just willy-nilly out there throwing this stuff out. This is one of their most expensive inputs. They don't want to waste an ounce of it.
But even if every farmer stopped fertilizing tomorrow, it could take decades for the nitrates already in Kansas groundwater to dissipate. And for towns that have not seen chemicals increase in their water yet, it's likely just a matter of time before they do. 3 years ago, Oakley Utilities Director Rod Huffman received that dreaded letter from the state. One of the town's water wells had too much nitrate.
We're at well 6, which was over the MCL limit.
So the northwest Kansas town of about 2,000 people plans to build a new filtration plant. It's already doubled the town's water rates to help cover the cost. And with fertilizer still a critical piece of the state's farming economy, Huffman expects more towns to face this type of dilemma. His advice? Bite the bullet.
It's not going to be cheap, but it's cheaper than not doing nothing at all. You know, it's just not going to get any better.
In Oakley, Kansas, I'm David Kondos.
John Deere is teaming up with Anheuser-Busch to raise money for farmers in crisis. Through July, both companies will donate to a foundation called Farm Rescue based on sales of Busch Light beer. Matt Blaylock, Deere's manager of sponsorship, says the limited edition beer cans are green, of course, and feature a Deere tractor, the 8RX model with tracks instead of wheels.
Because it represents modern agriculture, agriculture in the Midwest and in the areas in which we are. And then also gives kind of more to the general public, lets them see just the technology and how modern agriculture is done.
Deere has supported Farm Rescue since it was founded in 2005. And since then, he says it's helped more than 850 farm families in need.
When you've got planting to be done or harvesting to be done, and you know, in a lot of farm families, you know, there's a main person, and if they have an illness or something goes wrong, you only have a small window to go ahead and get a crop in the ground.
In fact, several Deere retirees from the Quad Cities are now helping Farm Rescue plant crops for farmers in North Dakota and Western Iowa. Well, the agriculture industry accounts for 10% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, and yet polls show most conventional farmers in the Midwest don't believe humans are the cause of climate change. Illinois Newsroom's Dana Cronin reports on a program that finds common ground in what farmers do believe and the fight against climate change.
This is a story about climate change, but to get there, we're going to start with a different environmental issue, one that farmers think about a lot. Soil erosion. Lynn Warfel has farmed corn and soybeans in Illinois pretty much his whole life, and he's watched a lot of soil disappear.
All of a sudden, there would, you know, a whole bunch of the soil would be gone. There would be a ravine there, kind of, a small ravine where I used to have soil.
The Midwest has lost about a third of its topsoil since Europeans first settled here. It's a problem that, unlike climate change, is urgent for many farmers. Some are taking action, like Joe Rothermel, who I met at his favorite pancake house.
Soil's a finite resource, you know, and we've already lost half our organic matter.
Rothermel also grows corn and soybeans. He is so worried about soil erosion that a few years ago, he set out to help farmers better protect that resource. He and his colleague, Steve Steerwalt, co-founded a program right here at this pancake house called STAR, which stands for Saving Tomorrow's Agriculture Resources.
So many people understand, you know, rating things by stars. You know, you may have been to a restaurant and then you check to see what the star rankings of it are before you go.
Here's how it works. If you're a star farmer, you farm with as many star practices that are good for the soil, as you can. The more you use, the higher rating your individual farm fields receive. So what does this have to do with climate change? Well, from Steve and Joe's perspective, not much.
We don't use the word climate change. In the agricultural community, that becomes a political term.
But even though they don't talk about it, the type of farming STAR encourages helps to mitigate climate change, because preventing soil erosion also keeps carbon in the ground. To show you what I mean, let's go back to Lynn Warfel's farm for a minute. He joined STAR a couple years ago and started planting cover crops on some of his land to protect his soil.
So what you see right there is cereal rye.
Cereal rye is a winter crop that goes in between harvesting and planting corn and soybeans. The cover crop's root system helps keep his soil in place and also sequesters a ton of carbon from the atmosphere. Warfel's also stopped tilling or turning his soil as much. Tillage starts a chain reaction in the soil, which causes carbon to be released. Now, instead of tilling this STAR field, what Warfel does is more like...
Just scratching the soil, and now we're scratching it less and less.
So the STAR program is inadvertently enlisting more conventional farmers in the fight against climate change. And that aligns with President Biden's goal for American agriculture to capture the same amount, if not more, of carbon as it emits. Paige Buck is with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service in Illinois.
We've been hoping for something like this for a long time. It started in Illinois, and now it's spreading.
Buck says the USDA has been glad to see STAR spread into other states, including Iowa, Indiana, and Colorado. She says what makes STAR so effective is that it's farmer-led and farmer-trusted.
Sometimes getting advice from the government or from getting it online, sometimes that's not what a farmer needs. What they need to do is they need to hear it from another farmer.
She says we need more programs like that in order to mitigate the worst effects of climate change. I'm Dana Cronin, Illinois Newsroom.
That story was produced with the Food and Environmental Reporting Network. We have more to come here on Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Almost half of all people released from prison in Missouri return within 5 years, but research shows prison education can help break the cycle. A nonprofit is betting on this approach, training the next generation of computer programmers while they're incarcerated at a Missouri prison. St. Louis Public Radio's Shayla Farzan reports.
On a recent afternoon in March, 15 men stood at the front of a cavernous beige room, each wearing a blue satin graduation cap. The mood was jovial as they whipped off their caps and tossed them in the air, surrounded by friends and family. The men had completed a six-month class in web development and programming with LaunchCode, a St. Louis nonprofit that provides free technology education. Thousands of students have taken the course over the years, but this graduating class is different. The students are all incarcerated at Missouri Eastern Correctional Center, a men's prison about 30 miles west of St. Louis. One of the students, Corey Pride, has been in prison for almost 2 decades.
Programming takes me away from any chaos that's going on. Like, I can zone in and lose hours at a time just programming.
Pride didn't know much about coding before taking this class, but he's learned quickly. Sometimes he gets so focused on his assignments that he'll work all night, the glow of his laptop the only light in his cell. Learning how to code has given Pride the tools to tackle a problem that he and many other incarcerated parents have faced, how to stay up to date on their children's progress in school. He built an app that he wished he had years ago, one that would allow parents to follow assignments and grades in real time.
You automatically linked up with your student, your child. So as we scroll down here, we were able to see all of the classes that the child is enrolled in and their current grade.
Decades of research shows educational programs prepare incarcerated people for life after prison and can help prevent them from returning. an inmate who takes an educational course has about a 40% lower chance of returning to prison, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. Haley Schoaf is the vice president of justice programs at LaunchCode. She says the web development course is designed to help prepare incarcerated people for jobs in the tech industry.
There's just a huge amount of hunger and aptitude and excitement from incarcerated students for learning these skills, both as a personal development and skill building opportunity, and also as they think about moving forward into the world.
But Schoaf says this program is about more than job readiness training. Learning how to code can help students think about how they might address challenges in their world. For student Avis Heyman, taking the programming class at the prison was especially difficult because he had never touched a computer before.
It was always hard blocks and things that I didn't understand. Errors just popping up everywhere on my laptop, and I had no idea of what to do or how to start it or go back and fix things. Oh, it was a mess.
Some days were so challenging that Heyman says he thought about quitting. But every small step, learning how to type, how to navigate new programming languages, gave him enough momentum to keep going. Heyman is up for parole in 2 years, and he says learning how to code has made him feel more prepared for life outside of prison.
I'm looking at commercials and I'm seeing how everything has advanced since I've been incarcerated. You know, I don't want to be left behind in society.
Some formerly incarcerated coding students are already navigating this transition. Chris Santillan participated in a pilot program through LaunchCode at Potosi Correctional Center. He left prison in February after 27 years behind bars. He's now working at a tech startup that designs learning management systems for people in prison.
With everything in my life being brand new, the one thing that has remained consistent is that I have this job.
Santillan says he's slowly rebuilding his life, a process that could be overwhelming. But he's trying to think about it like he's designing a computer program, step by step.
If I were to take that 10,000-foot view and just say, hey, how do I fit in with the world? It would paralyze me. But if I can take it, you know, down into simple chunks, like, okay, you know what? I have a morning routine. Or how do I clean the kitchen? It's not as scary because I've already formed these tiny little milestones.
Pretty soon, Santillan says, all of those little pieces will add up and he'll have a whole life. I'm Shayla Farzan.
A decision from the U.S. Supreme Court this summer could remove federal protections for abortion across the U.S. Side Effects Public Media's April Rickard has more on what that could mean for access to abortion in Kentucky and the Midwest.
A draft opinion leaked earlier this month shows the Supreme Court could be moving toward overturning the landmark 1973 abortion case Roe v. Wade. That would give states the right to regulate access to abortion. The decision's not yet final. Still, protests have erupted nationwide in the wake of the news, including in Kentucky, where a so-called trigger law would ban abortion automatically if Roe is overturned. That's from a rally where more than 200 people marched through the streets of downtown Louisville, protesting the potential end of Roe. Roughly half of all U.S. states are certain or likely to ban or severely restrict access to abortion if given the chance. Kentucky has been moving toward tighter restrictions on abortion for years. Last month, the Republican-led legislature passed a more than 70-page bill that includes restrictions on minors and abortion medication and bans abortion at 15 weeks. Kentucky Senator Stephen Meredith is one of 107 state lawmakers who voted to override the governor's veto of that bill. At a hearing in April, he said he wants to see the end of abortion.
This is a stain upon our country. It's our greatest sin. It needs to be reversed.
The law took effect and cut off access to abortion in Kentucky for more than a week. Providers said they couldn't comply with new regulations because they weren't yet in place. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the law. Stevie Binge is a medical receptionist at Planned Parenthood's Louisville Health Center. She says most people had no idea they'd have to leave the state to get an abortion. Reactions from patients ranged from anger to hopelessness. Binge says almost every patient they spoke with cried.
and they're trying to figure out how they can get to Bloomington or Indianapolis when they don't even have a physical means of transportation. And suddenly you're thinking about having to have an abortion and then take a bus home.
Bench worries that this is a foreshadow of what's to come if Roe does get overturned.
We're all staring down the barrel of how much more time do we even have left. The inevitability is eventually that anyone that wants an abortion is going to have to go to Illinois.
That's because Illinois is likely one of the only states in the Midwest where abortion will still be allowed if Roe is overturned. Megan Jaifo is the director at the Chicago Abortion Fund, which provides financial, logistical, and emotional support for people coming to Illinois for abortions. She says over the past couple years, they've seen an uptick in calls, including more people from Kentucky in recent weeks. It feels like a practice run of what could happen if Roe is overturned. But already, people are traveling in from other states.
People are coming into Illinois from, you know, as far as Texas, as far as Kentucky, just all across the nation right now.
Jaifo says providers are preparing, hiring staff and opening more clinics. Planned Parenthood of Illinois CEO and President Jennifer Welch told the Chicago Tribune she expects between 20 and 30,000 additional patients a year seeking abortion in the state if Roe is overturned. Providers say bans on abortion will disproportionately affect already vulnerable populations, people of color, young people, and those with low or no income who already have children. They may not have funds to pay for an abortion, a way to travel, or the freedom to take multiple days off from work. Jaifo says many are already being harmed by existing restrictions that push clinics out of reach or make abortion too costly.
This will just make it more excruciating than it already is. Roe is the bare minimum, and it's just devastating to think that we're going to lose even that.
The Supreme Court's decision isn't final yet. That's expected to come in June or July. I'm April Rickert, Side Effects Public Media.
A reproductive rights clinic based in Tennessee will soon have a location in Carbondale. Mawa Iqbal has more on that.
Choices provides birth control, abortion, and other services. The new clinic will be a 3-minute drive from Carbondale's Amtrak station. Executive Director Jennifer Pepper says Choices is expecting out-of-state residents to come to Illinois through Carbondale.
All those folks in Illinois have already begun to feel what it will be like in a post-Roe world where people will have to travel. And quite frankly, there will be more people that need access to care than there will be care to be provided.
Bordering Tennessee, Kentucky, and Missouri have trigger laws that will ban abortion if Roe v. Wade is overturned. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says the state will continue to protect abortion rights. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
That leaked U.S. Supreme Court draft opinion does raise the possibility Roe versus Wade could be overturned after nearly 5 decades, and that has Illinois lawmakers, providers, legal groups, and advocates strategizing about what they will do if abortion rights are no longer the law of the land. Maureen McKinney explains.
26 states are expected to ban abortion, and many of them surround Illinois. But Illinois has a trigger law that would ensure that the overturn of Roe would not force abortion restrictions here. Another Illinois law would require private and state insurance to cover the termination of a pregnancy. Last year, the state's parental notification of abortion law was repealed. State Representative Kelly Cassidy is a Chicago Democrat who sponsored 2019's expansive Reproductive Health Act, which made abortion a fundamental right in Illinois at any point in pregnancy.
You know, one of the things I've heard so much this week, in addition to patients being afraid of what's going to happen, is abortion care workers, folks who work in the clinics, concerned about being imprisoned at some point. So it's critically important that we are mindful of addressing those risks. And there's a lot more we can do. You know, we have to make sure that we're prepared.
This legislative session, the Illinois House passed a measure that would ensure healthcare providers in Illinois who are also licensed in neighboring states don't face legal repercussions. Some of the other possibilities for law changes in Illinois Cassidy listed include facilitating easier transfer of professional licenses from other states, providing support for the influx of inbound patients she said may be fleeing persecution and their own states, state support for coalitions that help with accessing abortions, making sure that state insurance issues are resolved quickly for inbound pregnant people. But attorney Peter Breen, vice president at the conservative Thomas More Society, said he thinks Democrats might have overreached on the abortion issue. The Republican former lawmaker predicts the stark difference in abortion rights between Illinois and neighboring states might be too much for some voters.
My hope is that that large difference will weigh on the people of Illinois to say, hey, we don't want to become known as the abortion capital of the Midwest. We're already known for bankruptcy and corruption. Do we want to add abortion to that list?
Planned Parenthood of Illinois says yes. Abortion rights advocates estimate that when Roe is overturned, Illinois could see a doubling or tripling of the current 10,000 out-of-state patients seeking abortion care here. Planned Parenthood has spent the last several years preparing for the eventual overturn of Roe by constructing new clinics near Wisconsin and Indiana borders and expanding their facilities. But beyond physical space needs, Planned Parenthood of Illinois President and CEO Jennifer Welsh says building out telehealth services has been a crucial step in ensuring women in both Illinois and beyond can access abortions here. Most pregnancies still in their first trimester don't need a surgical abortion, and patients can instead receive a medication abortion after a video or phone consultation and a mailing address in Illinois, even if it's temporary.
We anticipate that there could be between 20 and 30,000 additional patients coming to Illinois for abortions when all of the states around us eliminate access. And we expect for that to happen pretty quickly after the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. And I'll also say it's really happening now.
Texas in September enacted a law that bans abortions even before most people know they're pregnant. Amy Gerke is executive director of the Illinois Right to Life, which expanded a project that assists pregnant people with a link to crisis pregnancy centers and financial and housing help. That's to respond to the expected influx of abortion seekers from other states.
Really, no matter what the final ruling is, thanks to the Reproductive Health Act, the abortion business will be business as usual after the ruling, even if Roe v. Wade is overturned. So our strategy remains first to educate the people of Illinois about the absolute extremity of our abortion laws.
On Wednesday, Governor J.B. Pritzker went to Fairview Heights, the site of a new health care clinic where the St. Louis region's Planned Parenthood performs abortions. He argued for Congress to adopt the federal legislation that would codify Roe.
There is no archaic rule, no parliamentary maneuver, no matter what, that is more critical than protecting the lives and bodily autonomy of more than 160 million people. It's long past time for this nation to codify Roe v. Wade into law. If it takes overhauling the filibuster, then overhaul the filibuster. If it requires countless hours of pleading and deliberation, then get to work. If it takes courage, find the courage.
That morning, the U.S. Senate took a fail vote on the Women's Health Protection Act, which would make Roe the law of the land. Cassidy says people who already face hurdles getting access to health care, low-income parents, people of color, and people who are LGBTQ will be the ones most harmed if Roe is overturned. She takes the issue personally, having had a medicinal abortion with her first pregnancy when it was discovered to be ectopic. She faced death or the potential of losing her ability to have children.
Basically, my entire existence, my family's existence, is built upon that presumption of a constitutional right to privacy. I am a lesbian parent in a marriage with kids, with shared custody. Each one of those pieces is a brick in a Jenga game that I feel like I'm watching it crash in real time.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
You're listening to Statewide. Stay with us. There's more ahead. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, what does a new state audit tell us about problems in the state's child welfare agency? Well, up next, are you noticing itchy eyes and a runny nose, sneezing? It might be due to allergies. They can really act up this time of year. Pollen and other allergens can make life miserable for some. Tim Shelley talked with OSF healthcare allergist Naya Dunn about allergy season and the best ways to get relief.
Going into May is usually a tough time for a lot of people who have pollen allergies. Tree pollen starts being released usually in early March. But this time of year, you're starting to get some early grasses and some early weeds. And so in May, it's a time where people who are pollen allergic have to deal with multiple different kinds of pollen. And that's why May can be such a tough month for patients with their allergies.
Why did you have an allergic reaction to pollen, I guess?
Yeah, so usually pollen allergies cause a lot of sinus symptoms that could be runny nose, stuffy nose, sneezing, itchy nose. It can even affect your ears. People get ear itching, ear fullness, watery eyes, itchy eyes. Those are the most common symptoms of pollen allergy. Now, in somebody who has asthma, or even eczema, other allergic conditions, they can flare up as well with pollen allergies.
So what causes an allergy, I guess, more broadly? It's kind of like an autoimmune response, right?
Yeah, so it's actually caused by one of our antibodies called IgE, and it basically sees pollen or allergens as foreign particles. And so it mounts an inflammatory response when it sees those particles, and that kind of starts the process of an allergic reaction. So in somebody who's pollen allergic, their IgE would bind to tree pollen, for example, and start an inflammatory response that's usually in the nose or sinuses and sometimes the lungs or the skin.
And for somebody who's having an allergic reaction of some kind, what kind of relief is there out there? I'm sure there's got to be something for people.
There's a lot of options. The most effective kind of first line therapy is usually actually a nasal spray. So most people kind of think, oh, I should take an allergy pill, an antihistamine like Benadryl or Zyrtec. But actually a nasal spray can be much more effective. It actually works at the site of inflammation in your nose or sinuses. And there are actually several over-the-counter now, like Flonase or Nasacort, Nasonex, Rhinocort. And so that's always a good start for people. But if that's not doing enough and you're also on an antihistamine, then seeing an allergist can be helpful to both identify what you're allergic to and maybe there's things in your environment you could do differently, or to even consider allergy shots, which are a more permanent therapy. It's actually called desensitization therapy. So it can treat allergies more effectively than the medications.
Would that effectively be exposing you to an allergen in small amounts to basically build up a response to it of some kind or resistance?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the best way to describe it. So kind of small doses that increase every week, and your body starts to recognize that particle or that pollen or dander, dust mite, whatever it is that you're allergic to, and it builds up a tolerance to it. And so instead of reacting, it kind of says, hey, I know you, I'm not going to have an inflammatory response.
And for somebody who does have a pollen allergy, you might have the temptation to, I'm going to open up all the windows, I'm going to spend time outside. Is that going to make it better or worse?
Definitely worse. So that's one of the first things we tell people is, as much as you might want to open the windows in the spring and let the fresh air in, that's actually allowing pollen into your home. And pollen's usually released pretty early in the morning, around 5 a.m. And so for people who like sleeping with the windows open, they can really be affected from an allergy standpoint. And then being outdoors, I always want people to get fresh air, be outdoors. I think it's very healthy, but that can kind of inflame things and trigger a lot of allergies. So things like changing your clothes when you come in, just taking a shower and getting that pollen off of you can help with symptoms. And then, of course, if you are on medications, just making sure you have them in your system before you go outside.
Are there certain types of plants or trees in particular that people with a pollen allergy should try to avoid?
That's a good question. It really just depends on the particular person. And so, you know, I could skin test you, for example, and you might be allergic to maple trees and oak trees and birch trees. Whereas if you skin test me, it might be hickory and walnut trees and, you know, a different species like cottonwood. So that is very dependent on the particular person.
That's OSF healthcare allergist Nia Dunn speaking with Tim Shelley. She says skin testing can help determine specific pollen someone is allergic to, and she says to talk with your doctor if allergies are a problem for you. You're listening to Statewide. Another audit released this week points out problems in the state's child welfare agency. The Auditor General found the Department of Children and Family Services has failed to keep up with required reporting of abuse and neglect allegations and also failed to properly track referrals. Our Statehouse editor Hannah Meisel joins us with more details. Hannah, this is the second of four big audits that are likely to be critical of the Pritzker administration. This follows one that occurred last week about the handling of the massive and fatal COVID outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home in 2020. And now DCFS, it's an agency that's had issues going back decades. Run us through a little bit of that history and why this audit now.
Yeah, DCFS actually was the first standalone state agency dedicated to child welfare in the country in 1964, but definitely the last probably 30, maybe a little bit more years, there's just been case after case after case of kind of horrific, high-profile, attention-grabbing, you know, child deaths and murders, cases of abuse and neglect. You know, of course, these cases are the worst of the worst. They're an anomaly. But really, I think most people would agree that the state agency that's supposed to be on top of this should be striving to do as much as they possibly can to prevent, you know, not only the worst of the worst where, you know, unfortunately things might end up in death or awful abuse. One of those children was Tanasha Barnes, whose name is now on this audit because of the law that was renamed in her honor. Tanasha was almost 3 years old in 2019 when she was found dead, severely malnourished in her Decatur home in a urine-soaked blanket, and she had basically frozen to death in a back room of the house without adequate heating. I believe a window was broken. DCFS had had multiple points of contact with the family prior to Tanasha's death. She had been taken into DCFS custody when she was quite young. And this audit examines compliance with that law that was, again, renamed in Tanasha's honor. That includes requirements that ostensibly might have saved her life and the lives of other children like her.
So, Hannah, what were the major findings out of this audit?
So to start out with, there's this 37-question, basically, survey that's called the Home Safety Checklist. It's supposed to be performed in the homes of DCFS-involved families. Questions range from, is the electrical wiring safe? Is there a firearm in the house? Does the parent know never to shake a baby? You know, very, very basic stuff. But it's stuff that, again, if this survey is performed like it should be, could potentially save lives or be basically an early warning signal to anything that's going on within the home. And the first finding of the audit was that DCFS was unable to provide 192 of the 195 required home safety checklists that the auditors took in their sample. That is a basically 98% fail rate. Another thing that the audit found was that what's called aftercare services, they're supposed to be provided to a child and child's family, often by a social service agency that contracts with DCFS. Of 50 cases tested, about 60% of them didn't have the 6 months that are supposed to be provided documented. You know, again, that doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't all provided and just wasn't properly documented. It's also, you know, a matter of the family complying, and it's not always easy to get families to comply. The goal of child welfare somewhere in the last 30 years or so switch from being so foster care focused to, you know, more of a focus on family reunification, which is supposed to be achieved by providing suspected of abuse and neglect with these so-called intact family services. These can be a lot of different kinds of services according to, you know, what the families need, because folks who are under stress, you know, severe stress, whether it's poverty or hunger or mental illness or drug addiction, they're not going to be the best parents. And so these services are meant to help the parents, help the children, to just be a healthier family unit. Now, it doesn't always work, but if these services aren't being provided for the full 6 months prescribed, that is not great. One other thing that was in this audit, roughly 21% of the positions within DCFS that are considered funded were vacant in 2020. And then another basically 3,300 positions, 55% of the overall, you know, positions within DCFS, at least its organizational chart, were empty. Now, it's very possible that a lot of those positions had been sitting empty for a long time and, you know, no one had really thought to update the nitty-gritty of the organizational chart. It just speaks to how this agency has careened from crisis to crisis and just has not been able to focus on the small things that are supposed to make them effective.
The governor has repeatedly defended his DCFS director. What has been his and Governor Pritzker's approach to fixing this agency?
It took several months after he was inaugurated. There was a nationwide search, and eventually Pritzker picked Mark Smith, who was formerly with one of the state's largest social service providers that contracts with DCFS. It's called Aunt Martha's. Listen, it's a hard job. It's not any wonder why the state has gone through so many DCFS directors in the past, I don't remember how many years, but it's just been a very unstable agency and it's hard to get continuity. You know, Pritzker, for the most part, will point to, well, you know, the decades of problems before I got here, and especially to his predecessor, Bruce Rauner, who, of course, governed over a two-year budget impasse that slashed social services. We're living through a pandemic, you know, 2020, which covers the year that this audit was done. Just an incredibly difficult year. It's hard enough already to do these kind of child welfare jobs. COVID just made it, you know, a million times harder. But the governor has boasted about continued investments in DCFS, investments that are supposed to increase, for example, the bed capacity for, you know, the foster care system. Once you get rid of a bed or have the funding slashed, which happened during the impasse, the state lost about 500 residential and shelter beds within the child welfare system. It's very difficult to build them back up again. You know, it could take anywhere from 6 months to a year. Mark Smith, as DCFS director, beginning in very early January, he's been held in contempt of court in Cook County 9 times for failure to place a youth in care. Most frequently, kids are held in psychiatric hospitals beyond medical need. Every day, every week that ticks by, they're missing their childhood. They're not getting adequate school services. They're not socializing, and they're being held there for no other reason than the state doesn't have an appropriate placement for them. The governor has defended his director pick over and over again, and he is basically saying, trust the process. We're investing more money year over year to this beleaguered agency, and it's not going to magically turn around in 1 year or 2 years, you know, even the basically 3.5 years that he's been governor at this point.
Well, so obviously a lot of criticism is going around. What have you heard? What do you think might stick as we move through this campaign cycle?
This audit is not, you know, the most shocking. It's not like we talked about the report last week out of the COVID outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home. A lot of that was indeed very shocking. But, you know, this is just one more piece of evidence that Pritzker's opponents can pin on him. You know, when you combine this with stories of abuse and neglect of children, you know, especially the high profile cases, AJ Friend, for example, in 2019, again, a very, very basic job of state government to protect these kids. But I think that DCFS is going to be something that, you know, is going to stick with Pritzker. I think his opponents have already been using these failures of the child welfare system in Illinois against him.
That's Hannah Meisel, our State House editor. You can find a copy of that DCFS audit. It's at our website. Just go to nprillinois.org. Look for Statewide. And Hannah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We're out of time for this week's Statewide. We hope you join us again next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find all of our episodes. They're available at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. And also, you can get our weekly podcast through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.